The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anoushka Astana. Is there now a new divide in British politics? No longer simply left versus right, but open versus closed.
It's a sort of gulf between values and worldviews that happens to coincide very strongly with an age divide.
If this is right, what does it mean for the future of the country's main political parties? We'll hear from this week's panel. And coming up, populists win the day in Italy as anti-establishment parties make massive gains and create another big headache for the EU. What does it all mean? We'll hear from our correspondent in Rome.
The way they won the election was by really going full out anti-migrant, or having really anti-migrant campaign message.
But first, for most of the 20th century, British politics was a battle of left versus right. To put it bluntly, the divide was between those who favoured more state intervention versus those who preferred freer markets. And the parties tended to divide neatly, Labour on the left, the Tories on the right. But now things are not so simple, at least according to new research from a new think tank, Global Future. To understand the seismic convulsions of Brexit and last year's election, they say you need to look at politics through a different lens. I caught up with Andrew Cooper, a former strategist and advisor to David Cameron, who sits on Global Future's advisory board.
What it tells us is that the divide in British politics is increasingly one of values, worldview and culture, rather than the traditional old kind of left-right economic divide. And we saw that in the 27 general election result. When you look at the churn of votes, people in all parts of the country starting to behave differently. Tory vote going up most in very strong working-class Labour areas, not enough to win many seats, but their vote went up most in places like South Yorkshire, Durham, Tyne and Wear, whereas the Tories were losing ground in lots of their sort of traditional, rock-solid, safe middle-class seats. And the evidence is that what's driving that is this big kind of values gulf that has opened up, really turbocharged because of Brexit. It's a sort of gulf between values and worldviews that happens to coincide very strongly with an age divide in British politics. It was quite widely noted after the 2017 election that the kind of crossover point was at the age of 47. So on average, people under 47 voted Labour and over 47 the Tories had a majority. But it's not a kind of gradual curve, it's an absolute cliff edge. Labour led the Tories by about 30% among under 45s. And the Tories led Labour by about 30% among older people. And what sits beneath that is this very big gulf along the same age lines on things like how you feel about multiculturalism, immigration, diversity, asylum seekers, how you feel about feminism and the green movement and human rights. And on all those things, the research published last week for Global Future showed this really big divide. And either you've got a situation where under 45s strongly think those things are good and over 45s think they're bad, or over 45s sort of equivocally think on balance they're good and under 45s by a landslide think that they're good. And our thesis is that because of the kind of breadth and the depth of those feelings, it's extremely unlikely that these under 45s, once they hit the age of 55 or 60 or 65, are suddenly going to start seeing the world in a different way and suddenly become people like the current over 55s, over 65s, who think immigration and multiculturalism are bad.
And you talk about it as a sort of open versus closed divide, but you could argue that's quite derogatory when you're talking about people having closed attitudes. I mean, have you had some pushback against that?
We have had a bit of pushback, and there's no, you know, in a sense, we don't get into the semantics of the words used to sum up the point. Certainly no one's intending to be pejorative or dismissive. On the contrary, I think one of the reasons why we've ended up in this situation and why we face Brexit is because mainstream politicians were too dismissive of very legitimate concerns. I think the significance of the age divide is not a sort of life stage point, it's a deep cultural point. And I think what we can see that clearly when we think about the fact that under 45s are people who were born since the mid-1970s and became adults since the mid-1990s. And if you think about the world since then, I think it explains why they have a different worldview, because You know, these are people who all of their consension or political awareness is since the Berlin Wall fell and since the end of the Cold War. It's since the enshrinement of free movement of people in the Maastricht Treaty in 1992. It's since the foundation of Google in 1998. It's the internet era. And it's not at all surprising that that generation should feel very positive about all those things and the sort of openness and the changes that accompanied it.
And on that, you also said that more people under 47, I think it was, voted Labour, and more people over 47 voted Tory. That suggests that Labour's winning the open vote and the Tories are winning the closed vote. If that is true, doesn't this benefit Labour big time in the future?
Yes, I mean, I think this is an existential problem for the Conservative Party.
It's interesting that you've launched this global future think tank alongside key Labour adviser Spencer Livermore. You've also mentioned, I noticed, Tony Blair a couple of times. I mean, is there appetite for a new centrist party to emerge?
I think there is a feeling that there are a lot of voters in the country who currently don't feel that, that there's a party they can really happily, confidently, comfortably vote for. I think it's very unlikely that that gap would be filled by a new party, if only because of the history of the SDP, which, with lots and lots of favourable things for it, didn't make it, because ultimately the electoral system is very punishing towards parties that don't have a very strong base of regional strength and a very strong kind of demographic core on which to build.
OK, and just finally, what does all this mean for the local elections?
The local elections will be very interesting because it's a collision between what we see as the new divide in national politics, which is about culture and identity and worldview, versus traditional left-right, low-tax, high-tax, low-spending, high-spending policies. And we're going to see that particularly in London, where there'll be the only hope the Tories have of not losing in Wandsworth that they've held since 1978 and Westminster, which they've held since 1964, is if the old Trump card of council tax works. Certainly if we look at the general election results in Greater London, they were terrible for the Conservatives and would suggest that they're likely to have a very bad set of results this time as well.
Lord Cooper there. Well, I'm joined now by my panel, former Jeremy Corbyn aide, Matt Zarb-Cousin, from the Conservative think tank Bright Blue, Laura Round, and The Observer's chief leader writer, Sonia Soda. So, Sonia, open versus closed is now the divide. Are you convinced?
I definitely think there's something there, and this isn't the first time that we've heard of it. We had David Goodhart publish a book last year about somewheres versus anywheres. We've had Tony Blair talk about this dimension. So it's not a new thing to be talking about. I think the polling, actually, that Andrew Cooper's done is actually quite convincing on this. This idea that in the younger generation, we've always seen kind of people as they get older become more conservative, and this polling actually really raises questions whether the current younger generation, people born in the last kind of 30 years or so, are going to get more conservative as they get older. And I think that is convincing. I think particularly sort of around the European referendum, I think that was kind of a symptom of this new divide opening up. I think the real question will be, what does this mean for British politics going forwards? I think if we were a country like Italy with proportional representation, we might have actually seen new parties cropping up to cater to kind of the younger demographic who are very open and internationalist and, you know, probably would be very strongly Remain. There isn't really a party apart from the Liberal Democrats who stands for that. But because of our two-party system, we've actually seen kind of, although this new dimension has opened up, it's still kind of like shaking down around our two-party politics. But yeah, I do find it convincing.
Matt, on that, I mean, do you buy it as well? And where does Jeremy Corbyn fit into it? Because Sonia mentions the idea of a new party. What Lord Cooper said on that was, you know, the experience of the SDP in very favourable conditions shows that that's probably not possible. Now, Labour has won a lot of this open vote, but where does Jeremy Corbyn fit in all of this?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn certainly won a lot of support among young people under 45s. So that was obviously a big swing to Labour in the last election. But I would question the inference from this polling that he won that support because of his policies being open or closed. I don't really accept the framing of it. Of course, people who are older are less likely to be in favour of immigration. They're more likely to read newspapers. There's lots of factors why that is, but it doesn't mean that that dictates the reason why they vote for a particular party. And I think what Jeremy Corbyn did very well in the last election was really turn the immigration, anti-immigration narrative on its head by offering people a different story about why they weren't doing as well as they were 10 years ago, and gave them a viable route to improving their material circumstances that wasn't, we're going to cut immigration because it's driving down wages. It was, we're going to tax the top 5% more to pay for public services, to invest in the economy.
But in doing so, if you take any of this polling on board, manage to win the votes of people who probably are more open-minded on issues of multiculturalism and immigration.
Certainly, but I think that if there's a correlation, it doesn't necessarily mean there's a causation. And I would suggest as well, like in places like Peterborough, where UKIP stood down to support the Conservative candidate, Jeremy Corbyn picked up a lot of what were formerly UKIP votes, and the assumption would be that that came from all age groups, and that was because, as I said before, he told a different story about the fall in living standards than UKIP were telling, or perhaps even to an extent the Conservatives are telling. So I think if you do offer people a path to improving their material conditions, then I think immigration starts to fall down the list of priorities.
I think that one of the things that Corbyn and Labour did very effectively in the last general election, and lots of people have commented on this, is that they managed to attract these kind of new, younger, open voters while actually keeping, as Matt said, some of their kind of more traditional core votes. And I think one of the reasons they managed to do that and sort of combine those two things was because actually it wasn't a very strongly kind of pro-immigration message, for example. They just downplayed all that. So they were all things to all people. Now, that's a really politically skillful thing to do. But I think the question for Labour is, as we move forward on Europe, as Corbyn and Labour MPs have to come to kind of more defined positions on Europe, are they going to put off one set of voters while attracting another?
OK, well, we will come back to that. But let's just look at the challenges for the Conservatives for a minute, Laura, because one of the things this polling suggests is that actually the old idea that Sonia was mentioning, that you get more conservative as you get older, might be disappearing. I mean, Andrew essentially argued that a lot of the people we're talking about, the younger people, they don't remember much before the fall of the Berlin Wall. I fear that you don't even remember that. You've been telling us that your early memories are probably a long time after that. And the argument being that actually they don't remember the past. They've been brought up in this kind of much more multicultural world, the world of Google, and that as they get older, they will continue to have these attitudes. Now, if that is true, how much trouble are the Tories in?
Well, I think the main challenge, as you point out, which was demonstrated in the last election, is indeed the lack of support of younger voters. Now, our Bright Blues polling actually shows that that's goes beyond also what Matt was touching upon, beyond just open and closed. It's more concrete domestic policy. So like the environment, housing, education and health are all issues that they care very deeply about. I'm less pessimistic. Firstly, I think it would be very interesting to know what the 45-plus who were polled by Andrew Cooper's research thought about these things 40 years ago. We obviously don't have that data, but that would be really interesting to know. And when you look at the current Conservative Party in Parliament, the parliamentary party, the new generations, younger generations, are, I think, far more open in their values than older generations, and the new younger members are likewise. So I'm not that pessimistic. Obviously, it does demonstrate the need to capture the current younger generation now, because the longer you wait, the larger
the
challenge
is going to be. But
is
Theresa May doing that? Or are those younger MPs that you're talking about frustrated by the direction of the government?
I think Theresa May, obviously there's a huge challenge with Brexit, which overshadows a lot of things. But, I mean, the environment stuff is really positive, and that is something that younger generations really care about. But one of the findings in the polling, which I found was really interesting, is that the one thing that both the under 44s and the 45 plus agreed on, which is quite rare in this polling, was that they believe we're all citizens of the world, as well as being citizens of our own country. So that demonstrates, I think, that famous citizens of nowhere line really wasn't a smart move, and I think that was very negative, and that's really stuck with a lot of people.
And we touched there on some of the policies recently. We've talked about Europe, Matt. I've got this idea, this theory, that whilst Corbyn is essentially a Benite, quite sceptical about the EU, that his army of supporters, Corbynites, are actually very, very pro-EU and that this is an area that could become a bit difficult for the Labour Party. I did once ask him if he was actually a Corbynite, which he didn't quite answer. He said he was JC. But you tell me, is Corbyn a Corbynite and what is important to the Corbynites?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn obviously voted to remain in the European Union, and
you sure about that?
Yes, absolutely. And
he could have campaigned a bit more. Speaking from as a
to Jeremy Corbyn, he gets a lot of attacks for this, but he basically did more events than anyone else, didn't he?
He did. Look, he obviously accepts the result of the referendum, and we're going to have to be leaving the European Union. And, of course, his supporters, most of Labour supporters, are pro-EU. Of course, you know, they probably want to stop Brexit. But that's not their top priority. Their top priority is, just picking up on the point that's just been made about domestic policies overshadowing all of this, I think that's the real problem for the Conservatives. I mean, that's why we had the announcement on housing this week from Theresa May, because they know that under 45s, never mind what Thatcher called a property-owning democracy, it's turning into a property-owning oligarchy. The concentration of power and property is getting into smaller and smaller hands. And I just think that that's the biggest problem for the Conservatives. There's a generation growing up now that don't feel like they have a stake in society. And when that happens, they're kind of ripe for wanting a transformative programme, which the Conservatives aren't in a position to articulate at the moment. That's why they're going kind of Corbyn light.
Do you think they're going Corbyn light? And do you think they're in real trouble?
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, the problem is, it's very difficult to be transformative in government and come up with a new kind of new plan and new vision for how the country should be. So they ended up kind of aping Ed Miliband's policies, which they were calling in 2015.
They called it
some of the papers talked about Ed Miliband's policies on housing compared to Theresa May's identical policies on housing.
Exactly. And that's because they don't have any alternative, coherent answers to these problems. So they're just sort of veering left. And really all that does is open, if it doesn't work or doesn't have enough of an impact, it's just going to end up opening the door to Corbynism. And they'll be doomed.
And Sonia, just, you know, you're the Observer's chief leader writer. You've taken some, what I would call, pretty centrist positions in a lot of areas, particularly passionately over Europe, but over a lot of domestic policy areas too. Which voters do you think you are writing to at the moment? And, you know, is it the Labour Party that is the vehicle that, you know, most embodies those values? Or could it be the Conservative Party?
Oh, I personally think that it's the Labour Party. I think, you know, the Observers, I mean, I guess you could call us, our position centrist in some ways, but in other ways, they're quite radical, actually. On stuff like Europe, I think we are the paper who's, you know, gone out there and called it in our editorials like we see it. And I think, you know, it's all very well and good to talk about domestic policy outside of Brexit, and it is absolutely true that Brexit is overshadowing. But what I would say is that Brexit is going to be the lens through which all domestic policy is seen over the next 10 years. And I think the problem for Corbyn is, if Brexit does happen and Corbyn finds himself in government in the next 2 or 3 years, the economic shock could mean that actually his hands are like fairly tied when it comes to some of the more radical domestic policies that he does want to enact. I think it is remarkable though. I mean, I think we're, you know, the Observer may be centrist on some things, but we're actually pretty radical when it comes to stuff like market reform, you know. We're quite interventionist if you look at our editorials on stuff like energy.
Where would you stick them, Matt? Where would you stick them on the old axis?
I think of late, they sort of looked a bit like the propaganda wing of Chris Leslie.
Wow, well, that's quite a charge. Well, I
but the thing is, right, I understand the position that you have, and understand, you know, you're against Brexit, and that's fine. But this whole narrative about Corbyn should pin his colours to the mast at this stage, politically, it would be complete suicide, because we don't know what the government are going to negotiate out of the Brexit negotiations. We don't know. They could actually negotiate a bilateral trade deal with the EU, unilateral control of immigration policy, and ability to do trade deals around the world. We don't know. So to say Corbyn must come out and support the single market, well, that would be premature.
Yeah, look, I have sympathy for the argument that Corbyn also needs to think about the politics and, you know, how he wins votes. And so, I think the Labour Party is playing quite a clever game at the moment in the sense of holding different coalitions of voters together. But there is going to have to come a point where Corbyn takes a step back and says, look, you know, yes, we might win votes by being quite vague about this, but also we've got the interests of our voters to think about. And I think it's very, very clear that Brexit is going to harm Labour core voters. So I think he needs to be able to balance those two things.
And Laura, regardless of the issues around Brexit itself, we have had this change, if you look at the 2017 election results, in which, you know, the Leave vote largely tended towards the Conservatives, the Remain vote largely tended towards Labour. And as a result of that, your party lost a number of Liberal supporters. Do you think that Theresa May can win them back? And do you think there'll be any evidence of that in May?
I think May is going to be, yeah, will be very interesting to see, especially in London, where, of course, there's a lot of Liberal Conservatives, socially Liberal Conservative voters who backed Remain, especially like Kensington and Battersea, for example. I think the focus on the environment, again, is a really positive thing. I think they've woken up to the necessity of appealing younger voters, but also socially liberal voters, and actually open and internationalist outlook.
So what do you think? Voters. You think the cut down on plastics will win back enough votes in somewhere like London?
Not on its own, no. But, I mean, on immigration, actually, I think, you know, earlier we were all a bit doom and gloom about, you know, are the Conservatives really that closed? I think that's a bit of a harsh statement, because in fact the debate around immigration is far more nuanced than I think also this polling that we're discussing gives credit to. So Bright Blue's research actually shows that the scepticism around immigration can actually mask support for particular types of migrants, so especially students and highly skilled. And, you know, they want a competent system. They want it to be well managed. They want more control, which, of course, ties into the Brexit result in their campaign. And I think, you know, on issues like that, Brexit is an opportunity. And I very much hope, and Bright Blue very much hopes, that we'll see more on, say, international students in the upcoming months. So those are areas where I think Theresa May does have room to appeal to broader people.
So Andrew Cooper talks about the fact that a lot of younger people have different memories to older people. So I'm just going to depress myself here by finding out what your earliest political memories are. I'm going to put my hand up and say that I think mine was probably the Berlin Wall. I was about 9 years old. I remember that and the Italia-England World Cup bad result. Laura, go on, depress me. What was yours?
the memory that springs to mind most clearly is definitely 9/11.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and well, Princess Di as well.
Sonia?
I think mine was actually the Tory leadership contest. After...
Which one?
Oh,
John Major.
John Major, yeah, exactly. Way back then. So when Margaret Thatcher got kicked
off. Do you remember
the
twitching curtains? I remember her standing behind the curtains.
Yes, exactly. And I remember just thinking, God, like just looking at this list of kind of who I saw back then as really old men who were vying to succeed her. So Kate Clark and Michael Heseltine and John Major. And thinking as a sort of 10-year-old, wow.
which is interesting, because even though you and I might feel a little depressed right now about going back quite a lot further than both Laura and I suspect Matt in a minute, we wouldn't remember the kind of intricacies of the Cold War or even the kind of worst days of the IRA, which is what a lot of people are still trying to attack Jeremy Corbyn on. And I suspect you don't remember that at all, Matt. Go on, tell us your earliest memories.
No, my earliest memory was 97, and I woke up in the morning and GMTV was on. I think Eamon Holmes was a presenter then. And Things Can Only Get Better was playing, and Blair was waving to the crowd, and it was a Labour landslide.
How did it make you feel?
And think, well, I was feeling so optimistic, you know, and things did get better, and then they got worse.
So but, you were a Blairite before you were a Corbynite?
Well, not at seven, no.
Good Corbynites.
Well, you can have your say on our podcast page at theguardian.com/politicsweekly. Now, if recent European elections have seen the growth of populist insurgents, Italy took that theme to a new level this week. Out went the governing centre-left coalition, and in its place the mother of all hung parliaments, with the anti-establishment Five Star Movement ending up
the largest party. It's a result in one of the Eurozone's biggest economies that the EU could have done without. So what happens now? I'm joined from Rome by The Guardian's correspondent, Stephanie Kirch-Gassner. So, Stephanie, what happened on Sunday and how much of a shock to the establishment has it been?
Well, I don't think it's a shock to anyone who was really covering the election. There were a few things that came out a little bit differently than we expected. I think we were expecting that the populists would do quite well. You mentioned the Five Star Movement, which is a relatively young party started by a former comedian. It's very hard to peg it as a party of the left or the right. Their foreign policy is more on the right, and their economic policies are more on the left and social policy. So it's really quite a mixed bag. The other party that did very well is the Northern League, which these days just referred to as the League. It was once a secessionist party. It's very much, as the name implies, very much associated with Northern Italy, the wealthy bits of Italy. They've changed their tune the last few years, and the way they won the election was by really going full out anti-migrant, or having really anti-migrant campaign message. And so there are really two reasons why these parties did well for different reasons. We see that the Five Star Movement basically swept all of southern Italy, did very, very well. And there are direct correlations between economic growth or lack of growth and how well the Five Star did. And then in the northern Italy, we saw the Lega Nord, as they call them here, or the Lega, doing very well on an anti-migrant message.
So really interesting to hear that a lot of young people back the Five Star Movement. Just tell us about it, both in terms of its position on migration, economics, and on the EU.
It's very easy to think, that they must be the kind of lefty populists and the League or the right-wing populists. But it's far more complex. And in a way, they've gotten quite an easy ride by allowing that to be the perception of the Five Star. In fact, their economic policies, including lots of money for people who are unemployed, for example, those I would suggest are kind of more left-wing economic policies that they've endorsed. But in other ways, they're really on the right. I mean, there are some very strong ties between the Kremlin and the Five Star, for example. And on foreign policy, they've been very critical of NATO, and they have been very critical of Brussels and been Eurosceptic. And on migration, we've seen a real toughening of language there too, especially by Beppe Grillo, the founder of the party. They are never that clear about their policies, but I would say that they have more in common with the Northern League than with the Democratic Party.
And obviously it's a very different political system to ours. Which parties are most likely to form a coalition?
Well, this is the big question. Right now, there's first of all a big competition going on about who gets to lead the formation of a new government. The person who will be in charge of all this and oversee it is the Italian president, Sergio Mattarella, who has taken a kind of backseat in many ways. I think he's not expected to be too interventionist, but he will shortly be calling all the heads of the major parties into the presidential palace, and that's where they're going to start duking it out. Of course, there are two parties, like I said, who will have some preference. The Five Star Movement is the largest single party to emerge out of the election, but the largest coalition to emerge is the center-right. We call it center-right. It's actually quite right-wing, but it's we call it center-right party, and that was the coalition, rather, that was led by Silvio Berlusconi, the former prime minister. He's essentially been replaced because he did not win as many votes as Matteo Salvini, the head of the League. So you have Salvini, who is jockeying for position against Luigi Di Maio, who is the head of the Five Star Movement. It's all quite complicated, but the question is, who of these two will be able to produce a convincing coalition and present it to the president?
In which case, what has happened to the Italian left?
Well, the Italian left has been decimated. The Italian left needs to start rebuilding, and it's looking, you have central Italy, which was where a lot of the communist strongholds used to be, which is the territory of Matteo Renzi, the former prime minister, and they did very, very badly. The Italian left, the Democratic Party, which is the governing party at the moment, won 19% of the vote. and the Northern League won 18%, to give you, which is, you know, once considered a fringe party, is basically now on par with the left.
Stephanie Kirch-Gassner there. Now back to the panel. So Matt, really interesting that we're hearing from Italy is that actually the Five Star Movement, which perhaps I perhaps thought of as being more on the right than on the left, although it's very hard to pin down, actually attracted loads of young votes. Do you see it as a very different story than what we've seen in the UK and elsewhere?
Not necessarily, because I think it's a vote against the status quo and the establishment, which hasn't worked for a lot of people all across Europe since the financial crisis. I think we've had successive issues, falls in living standards. Lots of countries have high levels of unemployment, particularly youth unemployment. And to offer sort of third way social democracy, as the equivalent party, the left party, did in Italy, led by Renzi, who had said previously that Corbynism is electoral suicide or whatever he said, I think that's the wrong way for left parties to go if they want to survive. Because we've seen across Europe now, social democratic parties who have adopted this kind of third way and maintained it and kept it. Now, it's not appealing to people. People want change, and the Five Star Movement offered that. And I think left parties have to respond in kind, and that's why Corbyn has done a lot better than his counterparts in Europe.
And Sonia, really interesting to see what's happening to social democratic parties all over Europe, although of course at the same time Macron did very well with a centrist platform in France. What is going on all over the place?
Well, I think it's actually quite hard sometimes to draw generalisations across different European countries. I think for one thing, these countries have very different electoral systems, which actually makes a huge difference to results and how parties do. And I think in France, a lot of centrists or people on the centre-left in the UK and other countries kind of look to France as this beacon of hope. I think there were some kind of quite unique set of circumstances in France, which meant that a new party could be started. Macron was already quite an established political figure. So I think there are circumstances that are unique to France. I think in Italy, I think, gosh, if we think we've got structural economic problems here in the UK, I mean, look at Italy. Young people have had such a raw deal there. Also in Spain, in countries like Greece, for so many years. I think, you know, this is really kind of something, a trend that's been waiting to happen. I think the EU will be looking on in quite a worried way, though, because although the Euroscepticism that you see in a country like Italy is quite different to what you see in the UK, I think there is this sort of growing swell of people, you know, feeling quite annoyed about the euro, about immigration, particularly in Italy, like the EU's shambolic refugee and migration policies that we've seen over the last couple of years that have seen the poorest countries, or some of the poorest countries in the EU, like Italy and Greece, have to pick up, you know, most of the immigration that's coming in. So I think, you know, people in Brussels will be very worried.
Laura, it's International Women's Day tomorrow. Can I ask you about that? I interviewed Harriet Harman, who has for decades been a leading advocate for feminism in the Houses of Parliament yesterday. And she told me that the biggest change we have seen is the changing nature of female Tory MPs, from doughty, tweedy matrons of the past to Tory feminists of today. She mentioned people like Justine Greening, Nicky Morgan, Sarah Wollaston, Maria Miller. She also said the arrival of the new man in Parliament, which I think is men who care about women's rights, meant that this was an amazing opportunity to kind of turbo boost the women's right movement. I mean, do you agree that there has been this change among Tory women?
Yeah, hugely. It's been really, really positive, and it's quite inspirational to see, actually, Women to Win, which is an organisation run by the Conservative Party to mentor and encourage more women to stand, has been quite positive. Of course, Theresa May was one of the founders of that. It was
Harriet's
a
not
lot
always
more
been kind about Theresa May. In fact, I think she said previously she's no sister,
right? Well, I think there's an article going around the internet at the moment listing all the things she's done for women, but there was a lot more optimism before June the 9th, because actually when you looked at seats that were considered at the time to be safe seats, and we thought, Conservative Party thought they were going to win, there were a lot of those candidates were women. Unfortunately for those women, they didn't get in. But I think you're right. If you look at the current Conservative benches, it is a lot more progressive. There are a lot more women. There are a lot more men who are championing these issues. So, yeah, positive.
Okay, and Sonia, there's a lot of debate around in this centenary year who we should be memorialising. We've talked about Emmeline Pankhurst, we've talked about Millicent Fawcett, Jeremy Corbyn and Tom Watson have teamed up with actors today to call for a statue for Mary Wollstonecraft. Can you suggest any other political women, past or present, who have been underappreciated?
Well, I think every single woman who's been involved in politics is underappreciated in Ishker. But, you know, I think absolutely historical figures like that, we should be doing more to kind of honour them. But, you know, even women in Harriet Harman's generation herself, people like her, Tessa Jowell, for example, I think they were really underappreciated at the time. And I think what's nice about this current generation of women is I think some of the best politicians are people like Jess Phillips and Stella Creasy on the left. I think Anna Soubry has been one of the most vocal critics of the government on her own benches. They are women and that's great, and I think we're really starting to appreciate them more.
So interesting though what Jo Swinson was calling for this week as a Liberal Democrat, saying there should be a statue for Margaret Thatcher.
Do you agree?
Yeah, I think it is a bit odd not to have a statue. I know she's very controversial.
Do you agree, Matt?
I think we should have a referendum on it.
Well, let me give you the final word as someone who I'm sure is a, you know, tub-thumping feminist. In the year of centenary for suffrage, in the year of Me Too, which woman would you say is your biggest hero?
I think political hero, Mary Wollstonecraft. I think I completely back Jeremy Corbyn and Tom Watson. I think there should be a statue of her, definitely. Probably my mum.
Oh.
Otherwise.
There you go. You can get away with that. Thank you all very much. Well, that's all we've got time for. You can have your say and follow all our political coverage at theguardian.com/politics. The producers were Phil Maynard and Simon Barnard. I'm Anushka Astana. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.